Your eyes and your vision are under attack, damaging blue light from the sun, your phone, your computer, your tablet, even light bulbs and car headlights is constantly bombarding you. The good news is our eyes actually already have a line of defense to counter the effects of blue light. This defense is made up of three pigments called carotenoids. MacuHealth with MicroMicell, the only supplement with the exclusive patent on all three macular carotenoids and MicroMicell technology.
Do your patients know what presbyopia is?
There are people who are afraid of the press.
Have you talked to your patients about multifocal contact lenses?
I've heard the bifocal, but not
right,
multifocal.
Do you need help with your multifocal strategy? Learn more at the conclusion of this episode. With more screen usage and indoor time, myopia, also known as nearsightedness, is increasing and getting worse in children. Now, certified eye doctors can prescribe MySight One Day, the first and only FDA-approved soft contact lens to slow myopia progression in age-appropriate children. Visit CooperVision.com to find a Brilliant Futures certified eye doctor near you. Welcome back to part two of my interview with Dr. Steven Zucker. In part two, we will continue our discussion on the very interesting but often overlooked topic of liver health. If you're new here and you like our interviews, press like, subscribe, share, and hit the bell. Also, please leave comments. Be sure to watch our full-length documentary, Open Your Eyes, on Amazon Prime, Apple TV, iTunes, Google Play, and YouTube Movies and Shows. The next topic I like to talk about is something that I find very, very interesting because it affects eye doctors. Primary biliary cholangitis, because these people get dry eyes, and I guess they get dry mouth as well. So if you could, we talked a little bit about it before, but if you could kind of explain what it is, and let's kind of go through the symptoms and, you know, between the itchiness, the poor sleep, the insomnia, and I'll give you an example of a patient of mine who had a primary biliary cholangitis and had, I guess, you know, they've had it for about 20 years, and I guess they were told to go on a medication, I guess, Urso, about 20 years ago, and maybe they never went on it or for whatever the reason, and then they had insomnia, so they put them on Ambien, and the Ambien worked for a while, stopped working, 20 years, this is 20 years after diagnosis, and then they put them on Trazodone, and that worked a little bit and then stopped working. They doubled the Trazodone and the patient wound up with liver failure and wound up in the hospital with elevated bilirubin, jaundice, and a MELD score, which we're going to talk about, of 22, where before they went on they doubled the dose of the Trazodone, they thought they were fine. But the primary diagnosis was primary biliary cholangitis. So to make a couple comments about this patient I've had a while ago and about this disease.
So the primary biliary cholangitis is another immune disorder of the liver. So the difference between that and autoimmune hepatitis is that in autoimmune hepatitis, the immune system attacks the liver cells, whereas in primary biliary cholangitis, the immune system attacks the bile ducts, which in the liver. And the bile ducts are what produce and guide bile into the intestine to help you digest fat. And so what happens in these people is they can't produce bile is the main consequence when this inflammation causes damage to the bile ducts. And that can lead to a number of consequences, including you don't digest fats very well. And so you can get problems with that, but also with buildup of the bile constituents. And that can lead to itching, which can be a common problem. These patients respond. So it was, it's been probably a good 40 years now where ursodeoxycholic acid was found to greatly help patients who have primary biliary cholangitis. The theory behind it is that I don't know. I don't want to waste your time, but it's sort of interesting. So Urso means bear in Latin. And so urso deoxycholic acid is actually a constituent of bear bile. So bears make tons of it. Humans make it too, but in very minute quantities. In fact, it's thought that that's why bear gallbladders were considered prized medicinally in Asia for, you know, several millennia. It's thought that it was the urso that's actually in the bear gallbladders. So the urso is a bile salt that your body normally makes. So we're just supplementing that. And it's thought that that's a very water-soluble bile salt. And so it's protective against some of the more toxic ones that are building up because you can't secrete your bile salts because your bile ducts are all gummed up. So that's been around for quite a period of time, and it definitely slows progression of disease and even prevents progression if you pick the diagnosis up early enough. So people who are diagnosed early, are treated with Urso and respond, will have a normal life expectancy. They will do just fine. If you pick up the disease later, then it doesn't work quite as well, and you can sometimes see progression. In terms of, there's a number of symptoms. Actually, one of the more common ones is fatigue. These patients can get overwhelming fatigue, and itchiness is a really big problem and sometimes can be a very intractable issue for these patients and drives them absolutely crazy.
Why do they get the fatigue and the itching?
The itching, this may be too long for us. So there is a really, a very smart group in the Netherlands that worked it out. But there is something that accumulates in the body called lysophosphatidic acid that is what causes the itchiness. But we don't have a treatment for that as of yet. So we do have medicines that can help, but we're not super effective at treating the itchiness. But it's something that accumulates because it's normally excreted in the bile. And when you can't do that, then it accumulates in the body and you get itchy. The fatigue, it's not clear, but fatigue is a super common symptom. And actually, there's been some studies looking at a medicine called modafinil that seems to help with the fatigue in some of these patients.
And now, a secondary drug has come out, OCA?
Yeah, so there's something called O-beta-cholic acid, which is a synthetic bile salt that has been shown in people who receive urso deoxycholic acid but don't have a complete response, that if you add the O-beta cholic acid to that, that can improve the liver tests. So it's used as a second line agent.
Now, let me see if I understand this correctly. So you can't get the bile still being made, but you can't get it out of the liver. So, and the bile is a salt and an acid, and it's acidifying the liver. Is that what's causing the problem?
Would you say? Not so much acidification as bile acids. So they help you dissolve fat. So basically what they do is they saponify the fat. And so particularly what we call the hydrophobic bile salts, the ones that don't dissolve well in water, they tend to really destroy cell membranes, and so the cells get damaged by it. What the Urso is a very hydrophilic or water-loving bile salt, and so it protects against the damage that's caused by the more hydrophobic bile salts.
And is there any big side effect to Urso?
That's the beauty of it. I mean, there are side effects. Nothing is side effect free. But because your body normally makes it, it is very well tolerated.
So, and how about bone density and worrying about fractures with these people as they go into cirrhosis?
Yes. Yeah, so as we talked about, vitamin D is metabolized in the liver. And so when you tend to get deficient in vitamin D when you have liver disease, and that can lead to osteopenia, which is reduced bone mineralization, and osteoporosis. And so it is recommended that if you have a liver problem, that you should be monitored for vitamin D and receive therapy to maintain your levels.
And this patient that was telling me this story, they first were on Ambien, and then they went on another medication to help them with the sleep. Is that an unusual type of thing?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I would have a good explanation. Trazodone itself generally is not something that would injure the liver. So I'm not sure. It may just be that she was feeling poorly from the fact that her liver wasn't doing well, and that may have been affected her sleep.
And
I will add one thing is that when we talked a little about the liver being a filter, one of the things that it filters is ammonia. And ammonia, when it builds up a lot in your body, it can make you confused and you can be quite altered. But the earliest signs of ammonia buildup can be subtle. And one of the most common is reversal of the sleep-wake cycle. So it could be that she was actually starting to develop elevated ammonia levels, and that was manifesting as reversal of her sleep-wake cycle. So she couldn't sleep at night and probably was sleeping more during the day.
And for PBC, primary biliary cholangitis, the diagnosis on labs with the AMA and alkaline phosphatase, can you talk of why those go up to help diagnose PBC?
Yeah, so the alkaline phosphatase is an easy one. So alkaline phosphatase is a protein in your liver that is located in the little small bile ducts, the little tiny ones. And so when the bile ducts get injured, that level goes up. And that's pretty straightforward. The AMA, which stands for anti-mitochondrial antibody, is a marker for primary biliary cholangitis. Just like for other immune diseases, you'll have an anti-nuclear antibody or an anti-smooth muscle antibody. The one that is typical for primary biliary cholangitis is AMA, but why it goes up is not clear. But it's 95% of people with PBC will have an elevated AMA.
Well, that's fascinating. Now, if we move on to the patient with PBC or any other patient gets cirrhosis, talk to me about portal hypertension, what that is, how is that diagnosis made?
Okay, so portal hypertension is basically all it means is that in your portal vein, your pressures are elevated. So portal hypertension. Why does that happen? Well, the portal vein, I think we mentioned it earlier in the podcast, is the main vein that feeds the liver. And if your liver is very badly scarred, then there's a lot of resistance to flow through the liver. So the pressure in that portal vein increases to try to get the blood to flow through. And so the reason you get portal hypertension is because the blood is having a hard time flowing through the liver. Now, what are the consequences of that? Well, there's several. One of them is that the portal vein is actually the blood flows into the portal vein from your spleen. And so if the pressure's high in your portal vein, then that basically backs up into your spleen. And so people with liver with cirrhosis will get a big spleen. It will enlarge, and the spleen tends to trap platelets. So then your platelet count will go down. The platelets are the cells in your blood that help your blood clot. And so people with portal hypertension will have a big spleen or splenomegaly and low platelet count. The other thing that happens is the blood's trying to flow through the liver. It's having a hard time. So then it looks for ways around the liver. And one of those ways is through the veins in your esophagus, which is your food pipe. And so the blood, a lot more blood is flowing through these little tiny veins, and they get really big because there's so much blood flowing through them. And that has a term, they're called varices, just like varicose veins in your legs, but they're in your esophagus. And the problem with them is that if those veins get big enough, then there's a risk that they can rupture and bleed, which can be catastrophic. It can be very serious. So that's another risk that you have when you develop portal hypertension.
Now, someone who has grade one, I guess it would be grade one varices, putting on a beta blocker such as Chorguard, how effective is that?
Well, carvedilol is a great medication. So beta blockers can reduce those pressures in those veins, and so makes them less likely to rupture and bleed. There are two types of beta blockers. One is cardioselective, and those just work on the heart, and they don't help these big veins. You want a non-selective beta blocker, and there's a host of them, but carvedilol in particular has been shown to be the most effective both at reducing the risk of bleeding from varices and also reducing the risk of liver decompensation, so the liver getting worse. So we tend to put patients, anyone who we believe has portal hypertension, on carvedilol or Chorig.
And is there any significant side effects that they have to worry about?
The main one, so Chorig is the two main things it does is it relaxes the heart a bit, and it slows the heart rate. And so people who go on Chorig can develop, the most common things are fatigue, they can get symptoms of low blood pressure, like if you stand up, you get lightheaded. And sometimes the heart rate can go too slow, and then you also will have symptoms from that. Those are the main things you watch out for. So in someone that I'm thinking about starting it, I look at their blood pressure and their heart rate and make sure that they're okay and that I'm not going to make them too low.
And the generic name is Nadolol?
Oh, Carvedilol.
Carvedilol. Okay, good. And people do well with that. So that's good. Because yes. I know a patient of mine, they put her on that. I have one question. I know this is a silly question. Maybe you know the answer to it. Why is it more women that get PBC than men?
Nobody knows the answer. I mean, women in general are more common to get autoimmune disorders. They just have higher risk for that. And we do see men with PBC, so I have a number of patients with PBC who are men, but it does predominate. There was a great theory going around that cosmetics were causing it, and since women use cosmetics like lipstick, and that was debunked, but there was a period of time where that was one of the theories that was out there. So nobody really understands why there's a predominance in women.
And is cirrhosis really a disease, or is it more a histological diagnosis?
Yeah, exactly. So multiple different diseases can lead to cirrhosis. Cirrhosis is just how much extensive scarring in the liver. That's all it really means. But it doesn't tell you anything about what led to that.
So this patient who had PBC winds up in the hospital, comes out, had high bilirubin, had a very high MELD score of 22, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. We talked a little bit that the chance for them reversal, they could still reverse, but it's a less of a chance for her.
Yeah, I would be worried about that patient. So I would definitely start them on URSO, but the really the concern in her case is the bilirubin going up. If that goes up substantially, that increases the concern that she may not recover from that.
I think she was like 8. That's pretty high.
Yeah, that's real. That's quite elevated.
You know, and there's a chance for it to come down to.
I mean, it will probably improve if they start her on the URSO, but I'd be surprised if it's that high that she would have a full recovery from that.
And what would make a hepatologist happy if they went down from 8 to 6 or 6 to 1.8?
Is it? Yeah, I mean, normal bilirubin is less than 1 essentially, so you'd like to see it back in the normal range. So bilirubin is there's a few tests that tell you about liver function. Bilirubin is one of them, and the reason is because we all make bilirubin, you and I. It's part of heme metabolism. So hemoglobin is what transports oxygen in your red blood cells. Heme is the component that holds the oxygen. When your red blood cells die, so they live about 180 days, once they turn over, you release the hemoglobin, and that's where bilirubin is derived. So we're making it every day, just as our red blood cells turn over. But the liver is your only organ that filters it out of your blood. So if your liver is not working well, then your bilirubin levels build up because you just can't, you're producing it and you can't eliminate it from the body. So that tells me when the bilirubin is elevated that her liver is not functioning well.
MacuHealth, your science-born and tested solutions for visual performance, macular degeneration, and dry eye syndrome. New products coming soon. Embrace the science.
So we talked a little bit about labs. We talked about ALT and AST. So if we could talk about some of the other labs, the ALP. You talked a little just about bilirubin INR and albumin. And how do you look at those to help you with... Now I need further tests, and what further tests should I do?
Right. Yeah, so the ALT and AST, I think we mentioned that a little earlier, are proteins inside your liver cells. When they go up, it just means your liver is inflamed or getting injured, and so it's just a marker of liver injury. So something's causing injury to the liver. Doesn't tell you what it is, it just tells you that's what's happening. The alkaline phosphatase is very specific for the bile ducts. And so when that goes up, it usually indicates injury to the bile ducts. It can also indicate an infiltrative process in your liver. So that gets a little complicated, but things like sarcoidosis, where you have granulomas in your liver, will also increase the alkaline phosphatase. The three measures that we use that are standard lab tests to tell me about liver function are the bilirubin, which we just talked about, the albumin, and that's because the liver is the only organ that makes albumin, and so if the levels are low, it usually means the liver isn't working well, and the INR, which is the international normalized ratio, but it basically tells me how well the blood clots, so it's a measure of clotting. And it turns out that your liver makes every clotting factor except for one, which is von Willebrand's factor. And so if your liver isn't functioning well, then your clotting tests become abnormal. And so that's another indicator that the liver is not doing well. So bilirubin, albumin, the INR are the big predictors.
And if the albumin is low, that would mean malnutrition. Is that correct?
It can be. So yeah, what I always caution my trainees is that every test of the liver has other reasons aside from the liver that they can be abnormal. So albumin, you either aren't making it, which would be a liver problem, or you're losing it, which isn't the liver problem, but you can lose it in your urine by the kidneys. You can lose it in the stool, Or you're right, if you're very malnourished, then you don't have enough amino acids to actually make the albumin, and so it'll be low. So there are a variety of reasons it'll be low.
And is the GGT helpful at all?
I usually don't check that. So GGT will increase in problems of the bile ducts, but it's very nonspecific because multiple drugs make it go up. Alcohol, if you drink a little, will make it go up. There are other things that cause it to rise, so I don't find it very informative. I don't routinely check it.
And how about prothrombin time?
That one doesn't tell you anything about the liver, so we don't usually check it at all.
So let's talk about diet. What are things that you definitely want to avoid if you have liver disease? And what can you eat? And the whole thing about salt, some doctors say no salt at all, and then they're eating cardboard and they won't eat, the liver patients. So tell me about that.
Well, you know, it's music to my ears to hear you say that. So some of my colleagues do, in fact. So the reason we tell patients not to eat salt primarily is when they have fluid in the abdomen, because salt causes fluid retention. And so if you have fluid ascites, then salt can exacerbate that. But the caveat is that it's been shown that people who are put on a very low sodium diet, so if you restrict to 2 grams of sodium, which is pretty restrictive, people don't eat because everything tastes awful, like you said. And so it's much more important to take in calories, nutrition, than to take in a little less, you know, than to take a lot less salt in. And so I usually tell my patients, don't add salt, be cognizant of how much salt is in your foods, try to avoid the really salty foods, you know, like the potato chips and those kind of things, but you don't have to, it's more important that you take in nutrition. So people with liver disease tend to be protein malnourished, and so protein is your friend. And I generally try to encourage them to take in protein, and it doesn't have to be meat. You know, a lot of people, that's what they think, but beans, nuts, milk products, yogurt, particularly Greek yogurt, eggs, they all have a lot of protein in it. And that can be very helpful because a lot of people are losing their muscle mass and they need protein. Those are the main things that we tell them. And obviously, particularly if you have a metabolic fatty liver, then you should avoid the processed carbohydrates. Those guys are bad.
And is meat necessarily bad if you're using grass-fed, grass-finished meat, good quality meat? Is it necessarily bad to eat meat?
Not as bad as they make it out to be. I mean, generally red meat you want to avoid, but certainly the white meats I think they're perfectly reasonable.
And if somebody has cirrhosis, they have cirrhosis from, say, something else other than MASH, fatty liver. Should they be having 4 sodas a day? Should they be having high fructose corn syrup, or is it still bad?
It's probably not good for you no matter what. Even if you don't have a liver problem, I think that those kind of things in the diet are generally not good for you.
And raw fish supposedly isn't good.
It's probably not a big deal. The big thing that they talk about, there's something called Vibrio vulnificus, which you can see in particularly shellfish, raw shellfish, that it's thought that some people with some liver diseases may be a little bit, have a higher risk of developing severe disease. So there's some recommendations that you avoid raw shellfish, but I think it's probably not a huge concern. I mean, you can get sick from raw fish and raw shellfish, whether you have a liver problem or not.
So basically, just so I understand the diet, you want people to eat real food, you know, non-processed foods, stay, no matter what the cause of the liver disease, stay away from alcohol if you can, high fructose corn syrup if you can, if I'm wrong, correct me, and you want to eat, you know, real food and lots of protein if you can, so you don't get the muscle wasting. Am I pretty correct on that?
Absolutely, and maybe just don't overdo the salts.
And how about before somebody goes to bed, because the glycogen stores deplete quicker with people with liver disease? Should they eat some protein before they go to bed?
There's not, to be honest, there's not much data on that. I suspect it's not a huge concern.
So let's talk about when somebody does need a liver transplant. So when does it happen where somebody does need this transplant? And if we could talk about the MELD score.
So when they first started doing liver transplants quite a number of years ago, it was a little bit of a free-for-all, is that, you know, people would get on the list. It was first come, first served. Programs figured out, hey, you know, if I just take everybody and throw them on the list, then they'll accrue time and they'll get their transplants. And so there needed to be some mechanism to prioritize people by the severity of their liver disease. And that's where the MELD score came from. And so basically what the MELD score is an objective way to predict the severity of liver disease. So it basically tells you what is this person's mortality? And the higher your score, the higher your risk. And so the higher you go on the transplant list. And so the MELD score is basically just several lab tests that plug into a complicated equation that has logarithms in it. So you can't really do it in your head very well. And it gives you a number. And that number ranges from a low of 6. So I'm assuming your liver is fine. So you would be a MELD of 6. And it goes all the way up to 40, which is sort of the upper end. Someone who's 40 is usually in the intensive care unit, bright yellow, very ill. And so when a liver comes up, they basically say, who's the highest MELD score? And that's the person who gets the liver.
So I've heard you talk about the 6-minute test, that you have to be able to walk 250 meters in 6 minutes. If you can't, will that prevent you from getting a liver?
Well, so I have to qualify this, is that that test is used at some centers, but not all centers. But before I was at the Brigham, I was actually at the University of Cincinnati, and they have a big transplant program there. And the problem that I saw was that patients would be debilitated. They would be sick from their liver disease and they couldn't walk very well. And that predicts that they don't do as well after the transplant if you're debilitated going into the transplant. And so the doctors would come in and they'd say, look, you need to get stronger. You need to go to rehab and get stronger. And then we'll think about transplanting you. And then they would go to rehab and they'd come back and they say, I'm stronger. And they'd look at them and they'd go, I don't know if you're quite there yet. And so there was no target for them. And so I wanted to make it very objective. And so one of the things that we did was, there was a nice study that showed, a 6-minute walk test is very simple. All you do is you take someone and you have them walk up and down a hall that you've measured the distance, and you see how far they can go up and down the hall in 6 minutes. They can use a walker, they can use a cane, they can use crutches, they can sit down and rest, whatever, but you just want to see how far they get. They can have oxygen in their nose. Just how far can you go in 6 minutes? And what this study showed is that people who could not go 250 meters, which is approximately the distance around one lap of a track at like a high school, if you cannot do that in 6 minutes, the mortality of those people after the transplant within 15 months was 100%. Every single person was dead after 15 months. So what we would tell people is that if you can't do this, you're not going to benefit from the transplant because you're not going to have any significant life or quality. So it gave people a target. They knew exactly what they had to do, and it wasn't this spitball, hey, maybe you're a little debilitated, maybe you're not. And so it was a very objective way to do it. Obviously, not everyone can do it. And we didn't force people who weren't, you don't have a leg or something, you're not going to be able to do it. But it was a way to try to get a sense for how debilitated people are and give people a target for what they needed to do to be successful.
And is the transplant list a national list or a regional list?
It's a regional list. So the country is divided into regions, and each region has their list. And so you can be listed at more than one center in the United States. That's perfectly legitimate to do. But what I tell patients is it doesn't make sense to be listed at two centers in your same region because you're on the same list. It doesn't buy you anything. But different regions actually have the MELD scores are vary a bit. So some regions transplant at lower MELD scores. They have a bit more of an abundance of organs. And so being at certain regions benefits the patients. They get transplanted quicker.
And my understanding is 15 is the magic number. Over that, you need a transplant, or is that?
That's the general rule. There was a study that showed that people who had a MELD score of 15 or above, then the transplant, they did better being transplanted than if they weren't transplanted. If you transplant someone with a MELD score lower than that, then their outcomes were actually worse than if you didn't do the transplant. There is an exception, though, and that is someone who has cancer. So if you have a cancer and you need a transplant, obviously waiting too long is not a viable option. And those people will be awarded additional MELD points to try to get them a transplant sooner.
That's something that I forgot to mention about cancer being a side effect of cirrhosis. Why is cancer a side effect of cirrhosis? And that's something that is always checked if you have cirrhosis. They also check for hepatitis for cancer.
Yes, so there are a variety of things, a variety of risk factors for cancer in the liver. And metabolic fatty liver is a risk factor, alcohol is a risk factor, viral hepatitis is a risk factor, but having cirrhosis in general is a risk factor. It's not 100% clear why that's the case, but it definitely increases your risk of developing a cancer. And so we routinely recommend anyone with cirrhosis have regular screening for cancer, which is an imaging study every 6 months to look for any new spots in the liver.
And say somebody does have a high MELD and they have bilirubin is high. They're like that patient I had, like 22 or 20. And then they say, okay, let's see how your bilirubin does over the next couple of months. And at 22, they need a transplant. Have you seen it go down where they don't need a transplant and they get better? Not
Yes.
better, but they improve.
Yeah, or get better. Yes, that happens more commonly than you would think. So we try to be good at figuring out who is going to definitely need a transplant, and I think we're pretty good at it, but there's always exceptions to that, and it's dramatic how much improvement you can see in some people. It's mostly early on. So, for instance, if you have hepatitis C and I treat you and I cure you, most of the benefit you're going to see is in the first 6 to 12 months. After that, if wherever you are, people tend to be stuck there.
Makes sense. And how hard is it to get a liver transplant? How long does the average person have to wait, and how difficult is it?
That's a hard question. The answer is it varies by region. Generally, it depends on how sick you are going in. You know, there's the system is designed, if someone has acute liver failure, they can get transplanted in a few days. But if you have chronic liver disease and your MELD score isn't that high, I've seen people on the transplant list for years.
Something that I'm fascinated about is the living donor. How does that work?
All right, so it's a little different than kidneys. So kidneys make sense, right? You have two kidneys, someone needs one, you take one out of the donor, you give it to the recipient, that makes sense. In the liver, you only have one. And so the way the living donor works is you basically chop the liver in half, and you give half, leave half in the donor, and you give half to the recipient. And as you might imagine, so while the mortality, the likelihood you survive after a transplant is pretty similar whether you have a live donor or a deceased donor transplant, the morbidity or the risk of complications is much higher after a live donor transplant, because you have this cut surface of the liver and you leak bile and other things. And so it tends to be a little bit more of a rocky course early on after the transplant.
And why would somebody choose a living donor versus a typical donor?
That's a fantastic question. And many people won't. You know, it's a difficult calculation. One is you're putting a second person at risk, the donor. And, but you then get your liver right away. You don't have to wait on the waiting list. And about a third of patients on the waiting list will die before they get a liver. So it guarantees you that you'll get a liver, and you can time it whenever it's convenient for everybody. So those are the benefits of doing it, but it's at the risk of a little bit more higher risk of complications and putting the donor at some risk.
And how risky is it to the donor?
It's a small risk, but it's not trivial. So complication rates are non-trivial, probably a good 15 or 20%. And there have been a few deaths in donors after the surgery, so it's not risk free.
And when they determine if somebody is a living donor, I know it's blood type. What else are they looking at? It's just blood type.
Yeah. So the liver is really it's a unique organ in many ways, but one of it is it's very immune tolerant. So unlike kidneys where you need to match, or bone marrow transplants where you have to have, you know, extensive matching, the liver, all they match is blood type, and it does fine. So it makes it a lot easier.
Wow. Well, Dr. Steven Zucker, you're amazing. You have such a great way about you. You're out there helping people. And through my podcast, you're going to help a lot of people. And if people want to find out more about you, get in touch with you and your center, they want to become a patient, how can they do that?
Probably the easiest way, it's just Brigham and Women's Hospital. We're in Boston, Massachusetts. We have a website, so if you just look up hepatology, you'll see me and my other colleagues, and we'd be delighted to see you.
And is there anything that I left out that you'd like to add to the interview that I might have missed?
No, I think this podcast is just fantastic. I think it's very helpful for patients and physicians alike, and you do a wonderful service for them. I think it was a great time. I enjoyed it.
Well, Dr. Zucker, thank you again so much. You're wonderful. And speaking for my audience, all that help that you gave them, they're really going to appreciate it. Thank you so much, Dr. Zucker.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Your eyes and your vision are under attack, damaging blue light from the sun, your phone, your computer, your tablet, even light bulbs and car headlights is constantly bombarding you. The good news is our eyes actually already have a line of defense to counter the effects of blue light. This defense is made up of three pigments called carotenoids. MacuHealth with Micromycel, the only supplement with the exclusive patent on all three macular carotenoids and Micromycel technology.
Fitting multifocal contact lenses presents a big opportunity to meet patient needs while growing your practice. Alcon is your partner not only with our innovative portfolio, but through e-learning. Learn to enhance your multifocal strategy today with the Alcon Experience Academy.
OIE Broadcasting is the emerging leader in social media.
We use scientific entertainment to drive more patients into your office.
Visit OIEBroadcasting.com and sign up today.